This is Monocle on Design. I'm Josh Fennett. On today's show,
brands are so keen to hammer home this notion of heritage and identity, and every new creative director who comes in is billed as somehow tapping back into this ancient genetics of the house.
We sit down with the design journalist at the helm of Disegno magazine to digest some of the stories making headlines. Plus,
here in London we have both Canary Wharf, which, whatever you think about it, is a successful separate CBD from the city, and you have, of course, the city, the trading part of the city where all the financial institutions sit, and that continues to be a thrusting place of commerce.
Do we need central business districts? We talk to the architect behind a from-scratch city centre being built in China and examine the advantages and pitfalls of keeping these increasingly quiet spaces humming. All that and plenty more besides coming up on Monocle on Design. Do stay tuned. First up on the show, a digest of a few stories that have captured the imagination of our guest today, Ollie Stratford. Founded by Joanna Agerman-Ross back in 2011, Disegno is a thoughtful quarterly that covers everything from current affairs to academic findings through a design-minded lens. It also hosts its share of parties, panel discussions and exhibitions, plus lectures, as well as responding to breaking news in daily updates on its website. Ollie Stratford is the magazine's editor-in-chief, and I'm delighted to say he's here right now.
I've gone with three stories which show a little bit some of the intersection between design and current affairs, maybe. But maybe one of the first ones is a little bit more pure design. So this is Burberry's new logo, designed for them by Peter Saville, replacing the old equestrian logo that they had for some time.
And it riffs off the initials of Thomas Burberry, something that was obviously uncovered in an archive. And I think it's a bit of a throw ahead, obviously, to the first collection in September. But what does it say to you, this kind of latticed TB in these kind of like bold primary colours? How is that different from the previous logo? And what's the intention, do you think, behind it?
Well, I think it would look very handsome as an Instagram header. So I suspect it's been done with one eye on that. So it knits together, and these letters, they obviously are put forward as having this tie to the brand's heritage, but then they're also intended to look a little bit like a textile, so it kind of forms that traditional Burberry check. I think it will certainly play quite well on social media. It feels quite contemporary and colourful. But I think the main thing is brands are so keen to hammer home this notion of heritage and identity, and every new creative director who comes in is billed as somehow tapping back into this ancient genetics of the house, regardless of the fact that was announced with the previous creative director before then. And I think it's in an increasingly congested market, and when this very fast retail, everyone's bombarded, their social media, we want to try and stand out. It seems as if there's an effort to create some kind of anchor point or tie to authenticity in the past in some way, to provide a little bit of something concrete, I guess, that you can latch on to. Whether you believe that is another matter, but I think that's probably the intention behind it.
So we're all about innovation, but we're always riffing on the past. I completely agree with you there. I think another interesting thing is that Peter Saville has, over his career, worked on a lot of album covers, a kind of art that needs to be distinctive, that needs to jump off the shelf, that needs to live in a quite a small format and be very distinctive. And he's turning that skill, obviously, to a fashion brand. I think that's kind of a funny mixture of the old and the new, isn't it? To make something iconic and interesting, but that kind of comes from another era of recognising logos not on a phone.
Yeah, which is an interesting thing to apply the skill set to that. But what's quite disappointing, in a sense, is the logo itself. So you have the monogram, which is this textile-like TMB colourful. Then the logo is a sort of very plain sans-serif font, which looks very familiar if you've seen the Saint Laurent logo or the Balenciaga logo. It's surprisingly lacking in that kind of approach. I agree with you, you might have expected something given his back catalogue, maybe that pushed it into a slightly different realm, but it feels achingly contemporary and on point with what other fashion brands are doing at the moment.
Well, we'd love a bit of opinion on the design roundup, so we appreciate that. And I agree with you that the kind of the warp and weft of the logo looks safe and it looks old and it's taken from another era, and perhaps we should be looking to logos to move us into a new era. Our next story is a bit of controversy at the Design Museum here in London. I think we're all delighted when it opened up, the David Chipperfield design space, to give a bit of a home and a bit of a springboard to a mutual mutual interest of ours, the world of design. But there's been an exhibition that's not gone down so well with the people whose work was being exhibited, is that right?
Yeah, so the story is there's an exhibition at the Design Museum called Hope to Nope, and it's looking at graphic design and its intersection with politics. So there's quite a lot of activist art in there, for instance. The exhibition has been very well received. The problem is around the programming of the museum. So on the same night that the Design Museum was hosting Corbyn Mania, social media and Jeremy Corbyn as one of the events which go alongside that exhibition, they also hosted a private event for Leonardo, which is one of the world's biggest defence companies. And the defence industry is probably quite a polite phrase for that world. Activists, I think, pointed out a hypocrisy in that, to be exhibiting their artwork while at the same time taking the corporate dollar from Leonardo. And it's rather blown up.
It's a fascinating story, and the directors of the Design Museum pushed back. Dejan Sujic and Alice Black challenged the protests against the museum, saying that they are a charity and about 2% of their coffers are accumulated from the public purse. So, you know, how can an institution that is looking to, you know, raise the profile of lots of voices to talk about different things, to celebrate the work of lots of designers, you know, how can it fund itself if it doesn't appeal to different types of organisations that want to host things there? Where do you fall on this? Are they damn hypocrites, or are they sensible capitalists?
Well, I'm not sure I'd go down the sensible capitalist route particularly. I think the letter which went out from Dejan and Alice is a very realpolitik answer. They've expressed that there clearly are difficulties with funding, and in a sense that's the biggest story, that some of our cultural institutions don't receive the level of funding or public support you might want. Sort of government funding is wildly inadequate. At the same time, that doesn't mean, I think, that you can just use that as an excuse to then accept any kind of funding from any source. So there are clearly issues around it. I think what's damaging in this case is obviously exhibiting those activists' work and tapping into that world grants the museum a sort of, for want of a better phrase, kind of progressive sheen and puts it forward in a particular light and displays itself as an institution which is very politically engaged and socially engaged. Well, at the same time, if you're then hosting these events which are very embedded in this old industrial capitalist world and taking the money from that, I think that is a problem. Clearly, the issue is that museums need funding from somewhere, but I personally come down as it probably shouldn't be coming from the arms industry.
I mean, it's a very interesting point. I'm going to be a bit controversial, and I'm going to say that if you're going to have a say in or be part of the dialogue in the world, you would do well to speak to people in the defence industry, as well as the people on the far left of British politics, as well as the designers who are taking part. I think, you know, taking funding from an arms company, it sounds bad, but actually engaging in a conversation with people who make those kind of decisions for a design museum, I think they're allowed to be part of it and they're allowed to do it. Our final point is again about the ruthless manacles of capitalism and a design-minded company, technology company, in the form of Apple, which has passed a very, very major milestone in the past week or so. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so Apple is now has passed the 1 trillion mark, which is a ludicrously high figure. If you say 1 trillion to me, I just think of that old episode of The Simpsons in which Mr. Burns has a $1 trillion bill. So it's in that realm of sort of ludicrous wealth. I mean, it's an astonishing story for a company which not too long ago, I mean, 20 years or so, was on the face of bankruptcy.
That's right. They cut a third of their staff and they were 90 days from bankruptcy. Obviously, the role of Steve Jobs and the creative fallouts and the toing and froing of the company has become the stuff of thick books and Hollywood legend. But, you know, I think perhaps the interesting thing for watchers of the design world is that Apple, whether or not it uses design in the way that it advertises, always has design at the very forefront of talking about its product, doesn't it? The intuitive way that they're used, even the adverts.
Yeah, I think they've done some beautiful design work over the years, and Jonathan Ive's done an astonishing job there. I think they've also been very successful in terms of how they market that design work. So while there have been beautiful products, they've been very good, I suppose, about speaking about that design value. So even when, say, the industrial design doesn't particularly wow you, they've been, I think, quite canny and probably quite savvy in terms of presenting that very much as a part of their identity and trying to put across this idea that these are products which have been designed by people who care about how you use them and care about the user. I mean, they have a new advert at the moment sort of showing people behind the Mac, and it's a beautifully shot advert. I think it's very well put together, and sort of people using the products and maybe getting a little bit frustrated with their MacBook or whatever. You know, you can treat that with a certain level of cynicism, and I think you probably should. But equally, they've done a smart job of presenting the value of design and trying to bring that to the fore in what they do.
My special thanks to Ollie Stratford, the editor-in-chief of Disenio magazine. Now, the notion of the CBD has long preoccupied architects, developers and urbanists alike. How can we keep our cities busy after the itinerant workers leave for the night? And how has the increasingly mobile manner in which we work rendered them useful at all? Shanghai's upcoming central business district, a newly reclaimed area at the Pearl River in Shenzhen, is set to be one of the world's largest when completed in 2020. Stretching across nearly 4,500 acres of land, that's 1.5 times the size of Heathrow Airport, for a little perspective. But what's it actually like to build a CBD from scratch? Well, Monocle's Kurt Lin recently caught up with master planner James Corner, founder of the firm Field Operations, to find out a little more.
Shanghai is a new city where Shenzhen is moving east to the coast, and they see it as a fairly strategic city because it will connect Hong Kong to Guangzhou and also to the new airport. So it really represents Shenzhen's movement to the coast and to that transit corridor along the Pearl River Delta. It's a pretty big city, and it's a new city, and they want it built quickly. So our approach towards preparing the master plan and the vision was how to ensure that when that city is built, it has some qualities to it, and it's not just building after building after building after building, but that we're building a city that has a series of neighborhoods. Those neighborhoods are walkable. The neighborhoods are connected to a network of streets. The neighbourhoods are connected to a network of public open spaces.
Central to James Corner's idea of creating open public spaces is the integration of green pockets, a particular challenge in a country like China that lags behind when it comes to green infrastructure, while struggling with air pollution as a major health concern, an essential component that not only enhances the aesthetics of a place, but provides necessary spots of cool and shade, as well as improving air quality.
Central to the vision for Shanghai are 5 green fingers, we call them. They're actually massive linear parks that are also water processing machines. All of the water that comes into the city will be collected in these green parks, and they will filter and retain and improve the water quality as it moves into the bay. So there's a lot of really interesting initiatives in the plan that have to do with how to create a more livable city, a more walkable city, a city of neighborhoods, a city of mixtures. It's not just the same typology everywhere, but live, work, play communities. And a city that works hard with natural systems and natural processes to ensure that it's ecologically and sustainably healthy.
I was curious to find out more about the design and planning process behind such a large-scale project.
What you're trying to do is to organize a lot of stuff. You're trying to organize streets and block structures and parks and open spaces and transportation systems. There's a lot of stuff to organize, and how do you do that in a clear and simple way? It's part of something I'm very interested in. And I often liken it to, say, Steve Jobs and Apple. The complexity of a computer technology company is super complex. And yet part of the philosophy of Apple is always to clarify the organizational structures so that you lean towards simplicity at the end of the day. It's still complex. The complexity is still there. It's just that it's organized in a way that makes it more legible and more understandable and allows you to work in a more efficient way.
But do we really need to design purpose-built CBDs? At a time when so many develop organically, are they a necessary element for a thriving city?
Well, I think there's a certain economy and efficiency with a central business district, and that is to say that because of the density and the mixture, that you can go about your day fairly efficiently. Like if you have to have a meeting with somebody and it's only a block away, if your apartment is only a block away, if you're where you want to buy food and your restaurant and your museum and your park, if all of the amenities of your lifestyle, work, live, play, is all within a fairly compact area, then I think there's a lot of good sense to that. It avoids sprawl, it avoids mass transportation where you have to go to a meeting or go to a restaurant or go to a museum that's an hour away. So I'm a big proponent of central business districts in the sense that they ought to be mixed, diverse, live, work, play nuclei.
For an international firm like Phil Operations, with projects from New York to Seattle and Busan in South Korea, I'm curious to know more about the pros and cons of working in China.
Well, I mean, I think the sheer speed with which things happen in China, you know, they build a city in a number of years. That same city in the United States would take a long time. And part of it has to do with the efficiency of a state-run planning authority like you have in China, where they can just move, versus the democracy of the United States, where people can hold up a project very easily. So yes, there's a lot of differences between how cities get planned and how they get built.
China has never been a country lacking in master planning, but it's also got the reputation for some failed attempts at it, the notorious ghost towns. But given Shanghai's proximity to two big thriving cities, Hong Kong and Shenzhen, it's not likely the government will let this new urban development fail. Besides, it's sensible to have a new district to share the burden of the two dense cities that are almost saturated with inhabitants and developments. For Monocle in Hong Kong, I'm Kurt Lin.
James Corner, founder of Field Operations and the master planner of Qianhai's new CBD in China. He was speaking to Monocle's Kurt Lin. Still to come on the show, we look ahead to Monocle's next publishing project and proffer some sage advice on keeping city centres humming. Do stay tuned. Now, cities have always been important to Monocle, and our current July-August issue goes as far as to announce those that we believe to be the 25 most livable ones from around the world. Spoiler alert, Munich takes the top spot. But how have the challenges of changing work patterns and a loss of manufacturing in the city's centre affected our once-buzzing CBDs, and which nations are stopping the rot most effectively? For a few answers, I sat down with Monocle's editor, Andrew Tuck. If you recognise his voice, that's because he's also the host of our sister show, The Urbanist, on Monocle 24. I wanted to get his take on what makes CBDs tick, and what designers and urbanists can glean from some of the more successful examples. Andrew, I can see a few pages across the table from me that have been printed out from your forthcoming cities book. Can I call it your baby? Would that be fair?
It is my baby. It's a big fat baby as well. It's a romping interview. It will be on sale at the end of August. It's a Monocle guide to building better cities. And it looks at everything from the people who make cities through to topics such as leisure and pleasure, the building of parks, and even the nature of contemporary work in our cities.
And I want to hone in on one particular aspect of our cities and maybe turn a few perceptions on their head. We'll see how we go. The CBD as an idea is something that has been central to studying cities from the Chicago School in the 30s, where everyone thought that the cities emanated outwards from the CBDs. But in recent years, there's been a bit of a problem, and it's I guess, how to keep these spaces lively. What's the debate in terms of urbanism around CBDs? Are they everything they used to be?
Well, not at all. If you think about today, where is a group of companies sitting together that, you know, sum up contemporary wealth? Well, it would be Silicon Valley. It's disparate. is not in a city. It's deliberately shunning the city, in fact, building its own campuses. Here you have these huge generators of contemporary wealth, and they have no interest in the CBD. So that causes a problem for traditional cities with traditional CBDs in attracting tenants, making those places appealing. Because if every cool business and cool business person wants to be in one of these kind of like tech parks, then what's the future of them? And also the other thing is that I think there's a real feeling that if this is changing, what they're going to be used for, and this division that you could have these silos where you had a space that was just for corporate work, and the notion that people would just get on the subway at 6 o'clock and go back to the suburbs and leave these places shuttered until the next morning, it's not sustainable. We need to use all of our cities. We need to be active everywhere. We need to be regenerating neighbourhoods. So suddenly there's also this debate about, should these places also be places of entertainment in the evening and restaurants and things? So it's a huge amount of shifts going on in how we look at CBDs.
And I think that we're big fans of the bang and the clank of a hammer and the idea of making things in cities. Is there any opportunity that we could bring that back in the vacant spaces that once would have been service industries that are increasingly moving around? Is it just that our cities are more kind of permeable and we should be thinking about more mixed uses for a space that is no longer the preserve of a single trade?
Well, I think the notion of bringing back in making to the CBD is complex, especially in a US situation where you often have zoning laws that make that move very difficult. So I guess you have different cities in different states of play. So if you take somewhere like Los Angeles, for example, where the downtown core had died, there were still businesses there, but nobody certainly wanted to hang out there. It was felt to be dangerous. The public realm, the bits in between the buildings, were seen as unpleasant as well. Now, there's somebody where they've regenerated the downtown core. They've made it appealing again to people to run their businesses there. But we did a story recently on the CBD that Naples built years ago. They pulled in Kenzo Tange to build this huge CBD, which they felt would be a kind of a way of attracting huge corporations to Naples. And it just never, ever happened. It's a white elephant. Now, there they are trying to say, can we take some of these spaces and re-energize them? Maybe they can be co-working spaces. Maybe we can bring a different kind of business into the area. It seems that it's going to be a white elephant around the neck of that city for many years to come. So everyone's trying different things. And in a few instances, you know, life kind of goes on. Here in London, we have both Canary Wharf, which, whatever you think about it, is a successful separate CBD from the city. And you have, of course, the city, the trading part of the city where all the financial institutions sit. And that continues to be a thrusting place of commerce. But even there, we've seen the arrival of a new generation of hotels, of restaurants, of clubs and bars. You know, you used to drive through there at night on a Friday or Saturday and it would be dead, absolutely dead by 11 o'clock. Now, there are lots of things going on there. So again, re-engineering those places.
And do we live in our cities in a slightly different way as our cities get bigger, not necessarily always denser? Do we live in villages of our own around cities and only visit certain places for certain things? You know, I think that problematizes the idea of the CBD because I guess traditionally everyone would have needed to go there for one service or one thing. You know, do we need a focal point in our cities? And what would be the disadvantage, do you think, of not having these spaces?
Well, again, if you come back to the example of London, here our CBDs have been very corporate, very financial, very services driven. And actually, people didn't really use them. There was a retail core, which was the West End, and then there was a commercial core. And people who went to the West End often never went to the CBD ever in their life. So, yes, they're trying to make those places work again. But what they're coming up against is this fascinating shift in the nature of work. In that, you know, we talk about now the nomadic work. We talk about this generation of people who are working in shared office spaces, who have taken over kind of cooler neighborhoods where there were industrial spaces that could be converted for work. Now, that generation of people, that generation of entrepreneur, they have no need of all the things that you would traditionally find in a CBD. So then it becomes a little bit of a kind of challenge. If you're planning a city, if you're hoping for your city's future, do you still back the CBD? Or do you say, actually, we need to be putting our energy into creating these more interesting, intriguing spaces? And that is happening in London as well. You know, I would imagine in the years to come, the demand for additional office space will will fluctuate and change according to how we work. And you already see that many companies are saying, look, we want to spend less on the rent every year. Let's shift some people out of our offices, get them to use these shared workspaces, get them to work from home, and then we can shrink the sizes of our offices. If that happens as a really determined, dogged trend, then again, it's a threat to the survival of the traditional CBD.
And using the kind of windswept Kenzo Tange example in Naples, where I think the photos we ran in the magazine, beautiful buildings, but actually no one kind of populating the street, no one needing to go there. When we talk to developers, the phrase mixed use comes up a lot. And we see that, to draw on London as an example, in the new Bloomberg offices, where there's an arcade of beautiful restaurants and shops. Is mixed use the panacea that it appears? Is it the problem that's going to help CBDs come back to life?
Well, again, we're lucky that we have an office in Tokyo, and we've both been lucky to go to Tokyo and go to Japan and see how they do developments there. There, for example, the new Midtown development at Hibiya, a huge number of offices and great places for people to work. But it is properly planned from the beginning as a place where people will go for retail, for food, to hang out, to go for a walk with their kids. And then it's part of the city. And then it doesn't have these closing down hours at the end of the working day. So I think there you see a template for how it can be done well and how mixed use can be a saviour. But it's difficult retrofitting that to a dull CBD, which has none of the things you need to make it kind of appealing for everyday people. A good example here is Canary Wharf in London, where I worked for many years. And you know, I was desperate every night to get out of there because it pulled in only one kind of person. You never saw somebody walking with a dog. You never saw old people. You never saw kids on skateboards. And if you did, there was a security guard chasing them because it's not public realm, it's private realm. And then you felt that you weren't really part of the city's story. And that's the problem for CBDs. They attract a lot of people who are rushing around, even today, in a suit, going to a meeting, doing their stuff and then disappearing. And they don't have an intimate, deep relationship with the city. And that's the failure of not the people, but of the CBD.
And that was Andrew Tuck, a man who stands by when the elderly are chased by security guards. The Monocle Guide to Building Better Cities is at all self-respecting bookshops and available from monocle.com this August. And it's with regret that that's all the time we have for this week's show. Don't forget, you can download our shorter, snappier explainer show, Monocle on Design Extra, which airs every Thursday. And if you're still short of inspiration on everything from best-in-class residences, studios to watch, and smart fashion brands, then do delve into our summer weekly newspaper. It's available each week in August. That, or the design pages of Monocle magazine, of course. Monocle on Design was produced by Daphne Karnesis and edited by the ever-patient Christy Evans. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening. Ta-ta.